Welcome everybody to Pop-Up Stories. I am thankful that the weather is a little more cooperative. It's still snowing, but not quite as much. We don't have a foot of snow. So thank you guys all for coming out. I'm April Van Buren. I'm one of the producers for Current State, and I'm going to be filling in for Mark Bayshore, who, poor him, is on a beach in Mexico while we're all stuck here. But this is a good second option. If you can't be in Mexico, you can be here at Pop-Up Stories. I want to say a big thank you to Micah and to Katrina Daniels for hosting us tonight. You guys actually get the first sneak peek at their new exhibit called For Realism. So if you guys want to stick around and look at some of the cool art they have going on. And I also want to say thank you to our co-producers in this project, the Residential College and the Arts and Humanities, and especially to Katie Wittenauer over there at that table, and to Dean Steve Esquith. And if you haven't had a chance to write up a tiny tale, we've got post-it notes where you can write just a little shortened version of a story with the prompt, "I was never the same after ... and you fill in the blank. Before we get started, I wanted to go over a couple rules for our storytellers tonight. First of all, your story needs to be true, so it can't be something that happened to your cousins, dog walkers, babysitters, best friend. I'm sure it's a great story, but it's got to be first person. And it should be around 5 minutes, so we've got Katie Cook over here on the ukulele to help you out with your time cues. When you hit 4 minutes, Katie's going to give you this, and that's your 1 minute warning. When you hit 5 minutes, you're going to hear this. And that's not very different, maybe. It was different? Okay, it was a different chord. So that's a that's wrap it up in the next minute or so. And if you get to 6 minutes, you're going to hear this, which is as angry as we could make a ukulele sound. So when you hear that, get off the stage or we're going to have to break out the cane. So also, please remember to keep your language FCC regulation appropriate so that I don't have to go bleep you out afterwards. And now, without further ado, we're going to welcome to the stage our first storyteller, Judy Winter. So Judy, come on up, and I'm going to read a couple tiny tales before Judy gets started. So I was never the same after I had a banh mi sandwich from Capital City Barbecue. Must have been quite a banh mi. I was never the same after I met Megan. Is Megan in the audience? Nope. Okay. Oh, there we go. All right. Come on up.
Hi, everybody. I remember the exact moment that I heard my first grandson cry. It was just moments after he'd taken his first breath of life. It was November 3rd, 2014, at 10:03 in the morning at Detroit's Huxtell Hospital. Our son-in-law, Eric, had called to tell us the great news that our daughter was in labor and they were headed to the hospital. We got into the car, ready for the 90-minute trek to the Motor City, fueled by strong caffeine and greeted by a remarkable sunrise that set the tone of the magic of the day. Our kids had decided that they wanted to have the birth private among the three of them, and because we ain't the Kardashians, we agreed. So we hustled to the waiting area where the other in-laws were and grabbed Guy and Joanne and hugged each other excitedly and then waited for the news. But always the rebel, I invited Joanne to go prowling the hallways to see if we could see more than we'd been told. And we happened upon a closed door at the exact moment that a newborn's loud, strong cry was emitted. It stopped us dead in our tracks. And then we grabbed each other's hands and jumped excitedly and squealed like little kids who had just been gifted a box of furry little kittens. Now, to understand the joy of that moment for me, I invite you to travel back in time to September 25th, 1990, when my son and second child, Eric Richard Winter, was born. An unexpected problem during the delivery had left both of us in the ICU units fighting for our lives. Eric was left with a diagnosis of cerebral palsy. My wounds are much more invisible to the eye. I remember when the neonatologist, very somber, came in and talked to my husband and I and announced the diagnosis and told us all the things our just days-old son would never do and never become if he survived hospital infection. I dug deep. And in that moment, all I knew is others saw a disabled child, we saw our son. And we were determined to take him home and raise him, as we had his then six-year-old sister who did everything early and well and allowed us to practice parenting on her. Thank you, Jenna. So that's what we did. And we gave him every opportunity for independence and to have a great life, including nurturing a discovered gift for music. It was never easy. There were many missed milestones. There was the reality of a wheelchair and limited speech. But oh, the dreams and the love that this young child birthed that continue today. So we were devastated when on February 16th, 2003, Eric passed away suddenly and unexpectedly in his sleep at age 12. 2 days before, we had celebrated Valentine's Day when he had struggled to say to me, "I love you." And you bet I was present for every word. It was one of the lessons that he taught me. The Mylar balloon that we had gotten him for the holiday remained inflated mysteriously for 2 more years before we had the guts to throw it out. We were devastated, and I could have gone off in the corner with a bottle of Boone's Farm and checked out permanently. It would have been easy, but I'm not a fan of Boone's Farm. And my son lived so joyfully in light of disability and all the restrictions and the judgment that comes with it that we knew we had to honor him in a way deserving of his remarkable life. So my husband and I began a music therapy summer camp at MSU that is now in its 14th year. So back to our newborn infant, the king. I went in to meet him, and knowing what I had lost, this remarkable child, I put my finger in his little palm, and through the magic of mobility, he closed it on my finger, something my son was unable to do. And I knew in that moment, the part of my heart that had closed off when Eric died was starting to soften and reopen. We've had 15 months now of wonderful grandparenting joy and a lot of firsts, including watching this child take his first steps. It's been nothing short of remarkable. When Eric died, I was convinced my heart could never love that much again. I was wrong. What I discovered was that my heart was big enough to love both those boys. So by a change of heart, I ended up with remarkable healing and a full circle parenting moment. And the year since has been nothing short of grandparenting joy. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Judy. Next up, we've got Drew. But first, I'm going to read you a couple more tiny tales. So I was never the same after my dad died when I was 20. I felt that no one my age could grasp what the loss of a parent was like. I was never the same after being a summer camp counselor for 12 kindergartners. All right, Drew, come on up.
Hi, my name is Drew, and this is a Drew story. By the way, at the Oscars the other night, they played people off to Wagner's Ride of the Valkyries. If I go to 6 minutes, and I won't, could you take me out with that, please? Thank you. And if you don't know that, Elmer Fudd's Kill the Wabbit will work as well. So April was kind enough to send along some storytelling suggestions. Start with a setup, dive right into the story like our wonderful people have before me. I'm not very good at following suggestions. So the setup for this is I grew up on the west side of the state, idyllic, perfect childhood, mom, dad. I was the oldest of 2.4 kids. But a mile outside of town was Grandma and Aunt Stevie's old farmstead. Now, Grandma and Aunt Stevie are just the best grandparents that there ever were. Grandma, on Saturdays, would haul my scrawny butt over to Saugatuck, and we'd paint with all the creative people over there. Aunt Stevie, old farm girl. She could cook like you would not believe her. She was a crack shot with her pistol. Greatest grandparents in the world. Well, when I turned 18, I got out of school 6 months early, had enough credits, good job. And right after that, my mom died sitting on the couch right next to me. My dad went a little crazy. I guess I probably did too in retrospect. Moved out into the woods in a trailer with a bunch of my reprobate friends and did what we reprobates did in the 70s. Some of it might have even been legal. But I could always, Grandma and Aunt Stevie never changed. They were always in the old farmstead, a mile outside of town. One time I went out there, and there were a bunch of cars in the old ring-around driveway that I didn't recognize. I went in, because you don't knock at Grandma's house, and there were a bunch of gay, obviously gay men, sitting in the living room, drinking. They were playing music, and they were laughing up a storm, and they were just having a great time. Now, I knew they were gay men because I was 18, and therefore the smartest person in the world, right? But shoot, there's all these gay men in Grandma's house. I've got to warn her, don't I? So I found some excuse to take Grandma into the laundry room. Grandma, I think all your friends out there are gay. She patted me on the head. I had a lot more hair back then. It was the 70s. She says, "It's okay, dear. They're our friends." I says, "Grandma, I don't think you understand. Do you know what gay means?" And I'll never forget her answer. She put her hands gently on my face and looked me square in the eye. "Yes," she said, "it means that you've found someone that you love." Thank you.
Thank you, Drew. Our next storyteller is Jonathan Thompson. Is Jonathan here yet? Oh, there he is. So as he comes up here, I'll read you one more tiny tale. I was never the same after my first trip to the big city. I became a real city girl. So, all right.
Sometimes you have to die in order to really start living. So I've always been someone who enjoyed intoxicating experiences, but I've never been someone who thought of themselves as an addict or having an addictive personality. I went to culinary school, and if any of you have worked in restaurants, you know that working in restaurants exposes you to many substances. And I found that I could walk in and out of different experiences and different substances and not get attached to them, things that other people consider the really bad drugs that you're gonna get hooked on one time. I could try those things and walk away from them and not feel like I needed to do them again when they were no longer serving me. But in my early 30s, alcohol put its claws into me. And I spent about 8 years as what I would consider to be a serious alcohol problem. Many people probably wouldn't know that I was an addict because I was a functioning alcoholic. I went to work every day and I was successful, but I couldn't drive past the liquor store without stopping to buy a bottle of wine. I couldn't open a bottle of wine without finishing it. I couldn't go to parties or do things with my family and friends without being drunk. So as much as people, I probably was good at hiding it from people, I was an alcoholic. And then one day, I had a change of heart. One day, ayahuasca happened to me, and things were never the same. Now, ayahuasca is a word that signifies two different things. One thing that it signifies is this plant right here. It is a vine that grows in the Amazon jungle, and it contains a substance which gives it this bright orange color, and it's called harmaline. And it has a power over something in your stomach called monoamine oxidase, and it neutralizes it and makes it so that other things that you eat that would normally not have any effect on you suddenly can have an effect on you. And the other thing ayahuasca means is it's a brew. It's a tea that's made by shaman in the jungle, and they mix this plant with other plants, other secret plants, and it is a psychoactive experience when you consume it. And it's known for being a healing plant, and it's known for helping with addictions. So just about 2 years ago this week, I drank this stuff called ayahuasca, and I will tell you that it is the most disgusting tasting thing on the planet. It is putrid. People often throw up. People often crap their pants. It's a powerful experience. It's a very challenging experience. But the experience that I had was the most profound open-eyed visuals that I've had on any substance I've ever consumed in my entire life. And I've consumed a lot of substances in very large quantities. And I saw myself transform into a lion made of fire with my eyes open. I saw my friend unfurl glowing pink wings to block this dark demon energy from getting to another person. I saw a woman transform into a dragon. And it was profound and beautiful. But when you have a powerful, beautiful experience, I think there's always the other side to the coin. And I fell into a hole. And it was a dark place. It was like I was in a well, and my eyes were open and I looked up, but it was like the light that was coming into my eyes was far, far away, as I was in the bottom of a well needing to be rescued. My mind was a mass of confusion. I couldn't grasp who I was as an individual. It was just chaos for hours and hours and hours. It was the most challenging 4 hours of my entire life. But in the morning, when I woke up, things were different. I recognized immediately that being drunk was different, was the opposite of this place that I was, this elevated place, this feeling of being reborn, of having died and come back to life. There was nothing in the content of the experience that said, you shouldn't drink, that you're hurting yourself. But those were things that I knew already anyway. And what I knew was that I didn't crave alcohol anymore. It wasn't really a choice. It was just, I didn't need to drink anymore. And that was 2 years ago, and I still don't need to drink. And I have had like sort of headbutting with friends of mine who've gone through the 12 steps, and they say that I'm not really in recovery because I don't consider myself an alcoholic. But I'm not an alcoholic because I don't care if I drink anymore. And I've had drinks recreationally, and I'm fine, but, you know, like I said, sometimes you just have to die to really start living. And now I own the adage that there's really no such thing as a bad trip. There's just challenging experiences and opportunities to grow. Thanks.
Jonathan, is it legal for you to have that in here? I'm just kidding. okay, our next storyteller, Jay Wagar. Am I saying that right? Okay. and before Jay gets up here, I'm going to read another. This one is actually mine. I was never the same after eating real Turkish delight from an Istanbul sweet shop. I highly recommend it. C.S. Lewis knew what he was talking about. So, Jay, come on up.
Well, this is my first time to a pop-up story event, and I don't know anyone here. Oops, sorry. And I don't know anyone here, I don't believe. So you'll have to trust me when I say that basically I'm a laid-back, kind of mellow, kind of nice guy, and I non-confrontational personality. But back when I was in high school, I was still those things, but I tended to be someone who was bullied. So when I was a kid, growing up in high school, and particularly when I was a freshman, there seemed to be a number of people that would line up to pick on me. I was about 5 foot tall and 100 pounds, and just seemed to irritate people. And there was probably 8 or 10 people that just thought it was fun for them to pick on me. But over time, most of them, by the end of high school, they'd either just decide I wasn't worth the effort and ignored me, and a few of them, we almost became friends because I wasn't such an idiot after all. And so we kind of had a friendly relationship. But there was one guy who seemed to make it his career in high school was to torment me. And so pretty much all through high school, I could always look forward to him coming up behind me and giving me a shove. And I'd fall down with the books flying and the papers flying, and he'd be usually standing with somebody else laughing. And he was about 4 or 5 inches taller and 40 pounds heavier, and he almost always was with one or more other people, so I really didn't have much of a choice or ability to do anything to him. And life goes on. You finish high school, and I went away to college and moved back home and moved out of the country for a couple years and moved back home and went to graduate school and moved back home. I don't know why I kept saying I'd never move back home, but I did. And I'd see him around town. And of all the people I've ever met, he's the only one I really wanted to come up behind and say, "Hey, Dave," and smack him in the head, you know, turn him around and smack him. And it just always bothered me that I had this animosity towards him. And really, other than my events with him in high school, didn't know him. And somewhere along the way, I learned that he made custom fly poles. I said, well, that doesn't really fit with my image of him, but he probably uses them to whip people. Now, that'd fit. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, my sister-in-law came over to our house, and she says, "Dave so-and-so died." And I said, "Good." And she went, "What?" I said, "Well, he's always a jerk." And she goes, "Well, I worked with him in a factory, and he was a union steward, and he was always working to help people in their jobs. And, you know, working to help." Anyway, so in my mind, I'm thinking, well, he probably just bullied management to get his way. And so, but I felt regret. Well, I'm sorry. I really shouldn't have said that, is what I said to my sister-in-law. And another year or so went by, and found out that he died playing pool. He was in a pool hall and died, and they said that he just had a heart attack and was dead. But then I go to church, and one day someone came to speak after church, saying that she was had raised money to buy a defibrillator machine, and she wanted to give one to our church. And she's raised money to give them to churches and schools. And so, well, that's a nice thing. You know, we don't know her, and she's coming to do that. But it was Dave's daughter. And I thought, if he raised a daughter that had enough concern and love for people to help people that she didn't even know, to provide this device to possibly save people, then maybe people can change, and maybe I need to change too. So.
All right, thank you, Jay. Next up is one of my favorite humans, Shadonna Crosby. And while she's walking up here, I'll read you guys another tiny tale. I was never the same after my mom needed my help to get by. All right, come up here, Shadonna.
Hi, everybody. I'm Shadonna Crosby. I work in development at WKAR. So I guess I realized recently that I've lived majority of my life in flight. And what does that mean? I would say that I'm probably the most non-confrontational person you'd ever want to meet. If I'm at a play, somebody's phone rings, I'll give you the side eye, but I'm not going to be the person to say, "Would you turn your phone off?" or "How dare you?" But when the next person, you know, to me says it, I'm like, "Get him, get him." That's just my spirit. Ironically, though, when I'm at home and the doors are closed, I'm sitting down, I was flipping through channels the other day, and I saw Troy, and it's Achilles is, it's right there behind the beaches, you know, immortality, take it, it's yours. I'm on the couch like, yeah. And then Hector, you know, he responds back and it's, you know, honor the gods, love your woman, and defend your country. Troy is mother to us all. Fight for her. So everything is about the fight, right? That's what we idolize. That's what we, yes, the fight. Well, not me. Flight. I'm in the boat paddling in the other direction. That's typically how I was brought up. Folks are fighting over there. I'm going the opposite way, you know. And flight, I think, it gets a bad rap. But when you're a child, it serves you well. It comes across as you behave well. You're not a problem child. So you couple that with a bubbly personality, and I do. I kind of bubble bounce into the room. It served me well. Girls are picking on one another. The mean girls are in the corner. Not Shadana, flight. I'm in the other side. I'm doing my work. Why? Because if I don't, that's a confrontation with my parents, and I'm non-confrontational, so we don't want those problems. In middle school, it's the same thing. You know, I think I made the volleyball team, and I saw your tryout. You're not going to make it. Well, I'm thinking, well, I did really well. So when the list comes out and my name is on it, that's all the say that I need to give you. That's that. And that served me well. And I could list a barrage of things that through high school and college, having the flight mentality keeps you away from certain behaviors. Because again, I was always so concerned about what my parents would think. So that's college. As a young adult, though, I sort of took a turn about maybe 24. Flight started to affect my life in a different kind of way. I noticed that I was only on my jobs for 2 years. Now I'm 32, so maybe that's a generational thing, but it's like year and a half, up. And what's next? 2 years? Oh, not making enough money. What's next? Indeed.com. That sort of thing. So as a graduate assistant, I was at Miami University, 2 years in the membership department there at a public radio station. Loved it. Great experience. But grad assistant was up. Time to go. Where am I going to go? I don't have a plan. I'll go back to my boarding school. And I can't just be a Spanish teacher, so I'll do anything. I'll teach theater. I'll work in admissions. I'll be a resident assistant, anything to fill the week. But also, I'm comfortable there. This is what I know, flight back to comfortable. But then the school downsizes, and I get laid off. I don't have a plan. I don't know where I'm going to go. I'm flying back to home, to my folks. That's what I know. But it's going to be a confrontation without income at my parents' house. So it's spend 8 hours on the computer, you know, until you find a job, find a position. And then, you know, I spent the rest of the time at the gym or in community theater. And something interesting happened there, I will say. I had to strap on the proverbial boxing gloves and fight. Fight for a job, fight for their acceptance. And so I found a job and I went on to another public radio station in North Carolina. I flew there thinking that was the answer, but the problem with that was I'm without family, I'm without friends, I'm actually pretty lonely and isolated. What do? I call my ex-fiance, who's my ex-fiance now, and I reconcile with him and I come to Michigan because that's what I know. He's what I know. I'm closer to family. I get here six months at WKAR, love it. My ex-fiance comes in on one knee into my office. He shuts the door, he proposes. I'm winning, awesome. This was the plan, I'm gonna have a family. What happens? Unfortunately, he was cheating. So you jerk. Here I am without family, by myself, out here by myself. What am I to do? My first inclination, forget it, I'm done. I'm out the door. I'm going back home, or I don't know where I'm going, but I'm out of here. Something stops me, and it says, fight. So what do? First thing I do is jump out of a plane. I had some energy that I needed to release. So there goes that. The second thing is I started to take on different tasks. You know, Shadana, we want you to record this promo in 5, 4, wait, 3, 2, wait, 1, go. Hi, I'm Shadana. You take each situation as it comes, and I had to strap on the gloves and fight. So that's my change of heart, where when it's so in my nature to fly away when things get hard, I'm at WKAR and I'm fighting.
Great. Shadana. Next up is Katie Cook, who's also one of my favorite people. But before that, another tiny tale that's very sad and is going to make me cry. I was never the same after an almost dying kitten taught me the meaning of gratitude. That's very sad. Okay, Katie.
My story is a lot sillier than all these have been. So I have always loved movies. And with the exception of like the Disney princess phase when I was a kid, I have never really liked romantic movies or really like anything romantic just in general. I think part of that is because I don't like it. And then part of it, too, is that I don't want to be like a stereotypical girly girl. And so I have this image and I want to be like, I'm a movie buff. I like serious movies. I don't like the silly, you know, dumb romantic movies. I kind of think I'm like April from Parks and Rec. She's the character who's always like rolling her eyes at everything. And any display of affection or emotion she just thinks is disgusting. And I'm a little bit like that. So a couple weeks ago, I was flipping through Netflix trying to find something to watch, and nothing was catching my eye. And Pride and Prejudice showed up on my queue. And I was like, no, that doesn't interest me. But I kept coming back to it, and I was remembering like reading that in high school. And actually, I think I read the Cliff's Notes, not the actual book. And I just remembered not really liking it. I didn't care for Jane Austen. I felt like her themes were just all, you know, old-fashioned and the only point of life back then, if you were a woman, was to get married. And I was like, that's not me. I don't want to watch that. But for some reason, I decided to just try it and hit play. So I watched it. I loved it. Like, I was glued to the screen. I was so surprised that I liked it so much. I expected it to be kind of boring because it was like the 1800s, England, everybody was very proper and everything. There wasn't even any kissing in the movie. But they did this great job of like modernizing it and making a lot of the scenes and the dialogue more passionate. For example, there's one scene where Mr. Darcy is proposing to Elizabeth in the rain. And of course, she refuses him because she hates him. And the rain's coming down and they start arguing and they end up at the end of the argument really close to each other, like right in each other's faces. And I was just like, oh my God. This is so good. I was like leaning in and I just couldn't believe how much I liked it. So I just kind of went off the deep end after that. Like I became obsessed with it. To illustrate for you how crazy I went, I watched the movie, like I said, repeatedly. And the next thing I had to do was go to the bookstore and get the novel because I was like, I don't remember any of this from the movie. I have to read the novel again. I have to compare it to the movie. I have to see what parts they changed, what parts they left out, compare it to that. I started finding all the other adaptations. There's one classic one that the BBC did that Colin Firth plays Mr. Darcy, and I thought I had seen it, but I watched it, and I just didn't remember any of it. The novel surprised me, too. I had completely misjudged Jane Austen. I just thought that it was her language and everything was something that didn't appeal to me, but I was just glued to how clever it was. And it turns out that all the things I thought I didn't like about her, she actually made her main character, Elizabeth, kind of go against all of those things in the novel. And so I was just like, yeah, I love Elizabeth. This is a great character. Beyond that, MSU did a production recently of Pride and Prejudice, and so I work for Current State at WKAR, and I went to my superiors and I pitched them the idea, why don't I do a story about Pride and Prejudice for the radio? I was going crazy. I was trying to find friends who had seen it. I was asking everybody I knew, like, have you seen Pride and Prejudice? Have you read the novel? What do you think? And I even went so far as to buy the sheet music so I could play the soundtrack on the piano. So it's kind of a silly example of change of heart, but I learned a few things about myself. First of all, that if you starve yourself of anything, it's going to eventually lead to binging. But I learned that it's okay to have a change of heart. Like, it's okay to find out that you were wrong, even if you're finding out you were wrong about yourself. I don't want to be somebody who's set in my ways, because when you're set in your ways, you can't discover new things and like learn new things or grow. So I'm just going to own it. I was a closet romantic, but now I've publicly come out of the closet, and I'm okay with it. If I want to watch really good-looking people look at each other in the rain and not kiss, there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not going to be ashamed of it. I had a change of heart about romance. I had a change of heart about Jane Austen. And so from now on, I am going to watch whatever movie I feel like. And I'm never again going to judge a book by its author.
It is. Okay. We'll have to make a trip. All right. So next up, we have Ben Pineda. Ben, do you want to come on up here? Where did you go? There you are. Right in front of me. Come on up here. We don't have any more tiny tails. So if you guys have a tiny tail, raise your hand and I'll get you a post-it note. But if not, then we'll let Ben get started.
All right. Good evening, everybody. There's a great looking audience here. So in 1983, I graduated from Adrian High School and came to Michigan State University, and I really haven't left since, right? And when I came up to Michigan State University, I loved Michigan State. I love Michigan State. I bleed green and white. Lansing, the neighbor city, not so much. And I got to know Lansing pretty well as a undergrad at Michigan State, because I would get on my bike and I would ride out to neighborhoods where rivers were, a.k.a. the Grand River and the Red Cedar, and I would fish. I'd fish for carp, I'd fish for catfish, I'd fish for pike. And I saw Lansing in a not so very good light. I saw Lansing where red light and drug deals were kind of everywhere. And so I was always happy to get back to Michigan State, always happy to get back to Snyder Phillips and the comforts of East Lansing. And I do have a special place in my heart for East Lansing as well. So when I graduated from MSU, I became a teacher, and that's what I am. I am a public school teacher. I teach 8th grade social studies. This is my 25th year at Hazlet Middle School. This is my 28th total. And one of the things that is really awesome about being a teacher, which I think a lot of you students, and there are some of you students in here, snow days, right? And in 1991, pretty early in my teaching career, I was about to experience the very first day off of school, not because of snow, but because of cold. It was so cold, school was canceled the next day. We found out like in the afternoon, and it was like in the negative 20s, really obnoxious. And I thought to myself, yeah, no school, and we know a lot farther in advance than just the morning of. And so how do I celebrate? Pizza tonight. And on South Washington, there was a Little Caesars, which no longer is there. It's about, it used to be maybe an eighth of a mile south of where the Board of Water and Light facility is there now. And I was going to, and if you guys remember back in the day, Little Caesars had this promotion called Pizza Pizza. Yeah. One pizza, one price, and you get two pizzas, right? And so here I am on this frigid night in the minus 20 below zero, and I go to get my Pizza Pizza. And they had this other promotion where you get a free crazy bread as well. And so I'm like, this is good. So I come out, and you got to remember, this is the weather where you breathe and your nostrils freeze, right? We've all been there, because we're in Michigan, right? And as I'm walking to my car, I see something out of my peripheral. And it kind of startles me. And I look, and there's this guy, a tattered man, layered, but tattered. Layered because it's so cold, but tattered. And he doesn't have any legs. And he looks very homeless and very tattered. And he comes up to me in a wheelchair. And I remember, his demeanor could be described as basically rude. And he comes up and he's like, hey, hey, hey. And I'm like, yeah, and I really kind of took me. I was a little startled. And he's like, I'm like, yeah. And he's like, well, and he paused. And I'm like, you okay? And he's like, well, I need some help. And he kind of said it like that. Yeah, what can I do for you? Well, I'm hungry. And so, taken with the moment, here's the crazy bread. So I gave him the crazy bread. And from that, maybe a thank you? I don't think so. He turned around and was on his way down that frozen parking lot. And I'm looking at him, and I'm like, hey, where are you going? And he turns around, and he says to me, I got a spot under the Shiawassee Bridge tonight. You're staying outside tonight? Yeah. And he looked at me like, duh. Isn't there a place you can go, like a shelter or something? And he's like, yeah, I got there. But you know what? I got there too late today. They were full. They're full? And he looked at me and he says, they fill up every night. And off he disappeared into the darkness. And at that moment, something changed for me. They fill up every night in a medium-sized town like Lansing that I've only seen through the eyes of a red light district or a drug deal on the corner, feeling so safe in the river. And I realized this is a city that, because it has services like the City Rescue Mission, like the VOA, like Loaves and Fishes, services its community so we don't have homeless people running around like we do in other cities. You don't see that many in Lansing, do you? You know why? Because this community takes care of this community. And it changed for me. And I started to see changes. Real town, look at it now. What we call the Stadium District, which used to be probably the seediest area, look at it now. And here we are in Old Town. Look at Old Town. Fishing for walleye at 2 a.m. in that Branky fish ladder, I was so happy to be in the river, because what was happening out here in the late 80s and early 90s was pretty yucky stuff, and look at Old Town now. I got to tell you, I think Lansing has got an awesome case for being one of the most, if not the most improved city in the United States. And you know what? I love Lansing, and I have never left since. Thank you very much.
All right, and now we have our last storyteller of the night, Charles Upshaw, who is a return storyteller for us. As Charles gets up here, I'm going to adjust the mic a little bit.
April, first of all, I'd like to know how one gets on your favorite people on the planet list.
it's a pretty tough vetting process, but we'll talk after.
From high atop Spartan Stadium in East Lansing, Michigan. And that's not the beginning of my story. In fact, it's closer to the end. Home is where your heart is. I think most of us have heard that expression at some time. And my story starts when I was 9 years old. When I was 9, my parents moved from Oklahoma City to Denver, Colorado. I didn't know at the time, I couldn't know at the time, I was only 9, that this would be one of the most significant periods of my life. I was in 5th grade when we moved. And I had never attended an integrated school. I had never had a male teacher. I had never seen a for real mountain. And I had never eaten pizza. Okay. But Denver was my home now. I learned how to play clarinet in Denver. First chair, All City Orchestra. I started speaking in public in Denver. And I went to the best high school ever, anyplace. Okay. Now, during that time, in the fall, my father and I would watch college football games from high atop Spartan Stadium in East Lansing, Michigan. It's the Notre Dame Fighting Irish versus the Spartans of Michigan State University. Those words always seemed magical to me, even though I didn't know anything about the state of Michigan or MSU. My father died when I was 15 in Denver, and even though that was a painful time, Denver was still special to me. It was home. It was where my heart was. I graduated from that best ever high school and went off to college at a small liberal arts school in Kansas. And like most students in college, 9 months of the year I was there, but in the summers, I came home, tried to find a job, trying to find a date. And at the end of college, it was time to go to grad school. It was time to make application to grad school. From high atop Spartan Stadium in East Lansing, Michigan, those words seem magical to me still. And I hate to admit that those words and those memories might have influenced my applying to Michigan State. But they probably did. Now, to be fair, to be honest, I did apply to other schools, Boston University and Ohio State, and I have no idea why I applied to Ohio State. But I was accepted at both, but I decided to come to Michigan State. Now, the original plan was to come to Michigan State, get my degree, and move back to Denver. To be honest, I was a Denver snob. The banner on one of the newspapers in Denver says, "'Tis a privilege to live in Colorado." And I believe that. There is no place where the air was so clear and clean. There is nowhere where the sky was as blue. And I wanted to move back there. Sure, when I first got to Michigan State, I noticed that the fall here is pretty spectacular. Those colors are pretty spectacular, more so than in Colorado, but I was going to go back to Denver. Probably my second or third year here, I went home during the summer, and the pattern had changed. No longer 3 months at home, 2 weeks, 3 weeks tops. One night, a friend was over to my mother's, and we were having dinner, and the friend asked me how much longer I'd be in Denver, and I said, "Oh, I'm going home next week." Got very quiet. Got very chilly in the room. And my mother reminded me that that was my home. But over the years, I began to get more and more attached to Michigan. My mother died in 2011. She had been living with me here for 9 months. I took her back to Denver for the funeral. And after the funeral, I drove around town and realized that I felt like a stranger. That one-way streets that used to go that way are coming this way. That this door was closed. All my friends from high school had moved away and there was nobody else there for me. In the meantime, I started working in Lansing, worked for 40 years at St. Lawrence Hospital, made lifelong friends in Michigan, got married in Michigan. My kids were born in Michigan. I had my first MS symptoms here, but I don't hold that against Michigan. And a matter of fact, they built a handicapped accessible house in Michigan. Even after I'd been here for 30 years, people would ask me where I was from, where I was home, and I would say Denver. But I noticed when I was there in Denver that I missed Lansing, and I missed East Lansing, and I missed DeWitt, and I missed brunch at Beggar's Banquet and the MSU Dairy and watching the band march into the stadium on game day. So not too long ago, someone asked me where I was from, and I said Lansing, Michigan, because home is where your heart is. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Charles. Let's have a big round of applause for all of our storytellers who came out today. You guys were awesome. We have a lot more. We have a lot more events coming up. We actually, since we moved this one, we're gonna be out again in like 2 weeks. So we'll be at the Broad Art Museum in East Lansing on Thursday, March 24th, same time, 6 o'clock. So we'd love to see you guys there again. If you want to tell another story, the theme is going to be Lucky Break. So start thinking about that. Another big thank you to Micah and Katrina for hosting us tonight. If you guys want to take a look around, we have a little time. So if you want to look at the art and grab some cookies and punch on your way out, feel free. And thank you so much for coming out today. All right.